Rabbi Moshe Akiva Brandeis.
Mishenichnas Adar Marbin Besimcha. Seems to be a rather untimely Gemara to quote at this stage of the month. The question is, how far and how long does Mishenichnas Adar last?
Till Mamatim.
Till Mamatim.
Till Rosh
Chodesh. So when is Avtil? Till Adar? We're in trouble. There's a Moedig Rashi on the Gemara where this memory is. The Gemara is in Tanis Choftes Amud Aleph. The Gemara says, Amar Rav Yehuda B'reid Rav Shmuel Bar Shilas Mishmei D'Rav. Kishem Shemishenichnas Av Mema'atin B'Simcha. Just like one decreases the Simcha when Av begins, so too, Kach Mishenichnas Adar Marbin B'Simcha. When Adar begins, we increase the Simcha. Rashi says in Tanis, Yemei Nisim, Hoyu Li Yisrael, there were days of miracles, days of Nisim for Klal Yisrael, Purim, Upesach. So you have a Mefurish Rashi, that Mishenichnas Adar actually carries through, not only through Adar, but it goes continuously on through Nisan. There seems to be some sort of connection between the Nisan that happened during Adar, Purim, and the Nisan that happened during Nisan, Pesach. What's interesting is that in Adar, we don't find any halachas. There's no siman in Shulchan Aruch of how to be marbe b'simcha. When it comes to Av, we have Tov Kuf Mem Tes and the simonim that follow it, that tell us exactly how to be mamayit b'simcha. When it comes to the 9 days, the halachas become more stringent, and then there's the Shavuot Shechol Bo, the week that Tisha B'Av falls, Tisha B'Av itself up to Chatzos. And Adar, we don't find any halachas. Perhaps the idea is that in Adar, you marbe b'simcha. Yiddish life, a Torah life, is a life of happiness. Pekudei Hashem Yishar Mesamchei Lev. So it comes to Adar, increase with more enthusiasm, with more excitement. Do the things you do anyway, the chesed you do, the Torah you learn, the kviyas we have, whatever it is, do it with more enthusiasm. Comes to Av, what am I supposed to do? Give less tzedakah? Do less chesed? Fall out with my neighbors? What am I supposed to do? Av. So we need halachas. You've got Tovkuf, Memtes, the Simonim begin. The halachas need to tell us exactly how to be ma'at b'simcha. I'm living a Torah life, but there's ways. Less, wash less clothes, bathe less, whatever it is, we have the halachas of Av. But somehow there seems to be a connection. Adar, Nisan, Pesach and Purim. Before we see how they're connected, let's first see the differences. First of all, the Gros says in Megillas Esther, in the second pasuk of the Megillah, he says, Yitzias Mitzrayim, going out of Mitzrayim was the goli, was all revealed, was open miracles, open Nisan. It was a huge demonstration, a national demonstration of the Ribbono Shel'Olam's glory. You had 3 million people walking out of Mitzrayim from an empire that no one, no slave had ever dared or succeeded to escape. They went out after all the makkas that they saw. There was water turning into blood, frogs everywhere, locusts, hailstones, missiles. Firstborns are dying. It was open Nisan. And then they're going out to Mitzrayim and the Anani HaKovid, there's a telling them where to go, flattening out the sand dunes, a fire at night, a pillar of fire that's lighting up the way. Purim was totally different, says the Gro. Purim was totally natural. You couldn't tell anything supernatural was happening during the events of Purim. It would take a discerning eye to actually recognize and notice that Hashem's hand is throughout all these events that were taking place over 9 years. Nothing spectacular was happening. It takes a keen observer to actually watch all the happenings of Haman getting rid of Vashti, making place for Esther, who would eventually bring the salvation, the gallows, which was originally for Mordechai. Haman's end up swinging on it with his 10 sons. It takes somebody to actually watch carefully all the happenings to see that the Ribbono Shel Olam's hand is all the way through it, every detail, every stage. That's the gross difference between Adar and Nisan, Purim and Pesach. There's also a practical difference. The practical difference is, in the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Peches Amud Aleph, the Gemara says that Kabbalas HaTorah, which was the climax of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Liyos Lachem Lelikim, Hashem says, I took you out of Mitzrayim all so that I should be able to become your Ribbono Shel Olam, meaning at Matan Torah, when Klal Yisrael became a nation. And the Gemara tells us that Kofar Aleim Har Kegigis. It was by force. Kabbalah HaTorah, the Ribbono Shel Olam lifts up the mountain and tells them, unless you are Makabel the Torah, Shom Tehei Kvarashem, unless you accept this Torah, this will be your burial place. It's over. And Tosus in Shabbos asks, didn't they say Nasa V'Nishma? This is Klal Yisrael. When they were offered the Torah, they said, of course we're accepting the Torah. After all they've seen, the great demonstration of the Ribbono Shel Olam's glory and might and power, Klal Yisrael said, we trust you blindly. After all the miracles we've seen, Kriyas Yamsuf, Yetzias Mitzrayim, Esser Makkos, all that we've seen, of course, whatever it is that you want to give us, it must be for our good. Nasa V'Nishma. So why did the Ribbono Shel Olam seem to need to lift up the mountain and say, I'm forcing you to accept this? They were happy to accept it. Says Tosfos, Hashem was worried, so to speak, that when they see the Esh HaGdolah, the great fire, that was to come, they would maybe regret their decision. So yes, after seeing all the glory, you accept happily, Nasa V'Nishma, we accept before even knowing what it says in the Torah. But maybe when you see the great fires, meaning the fires of the future, Inquisition, Tach V'Tat, Communists, Bolsheviks, World Wars, Holocaust, maybe you'll start regretting your decision. And therefore you have to know, in all circumstances, Kabbalah HaTorah. We're a Torah nation, come what may. Purim was very different. The Gemara says, Hodor kibruha bimei Achashverosh. They once again accepted the same Torah in the times of Achashverosh. Says Rashi, mi'ahavas hanes shenazalim. From the love of the miracles that transpired during Purim, they once again accepted the Torah mi'ahava. I want to explain the difference through two little stories. There was once a fellow who adopted a boy. And he showered him with everything. He gave him clothes, paid his tuition, gave him food. He literally spoiled him, showered him with everything. And as the boy grew up, not knowing anything but luxury and comforts, it was time for him to start establishing himself and get a job. So his father says to him, I have a job for you. So he turns around to his surrogate father and he says, whatever it is, I accept it. If you're offering a job, it must be for my good. You've been so good to me over all these years. It must be the right thing for me. I accept a job. Nasa V'Nishma. And then he goes to work the first day. It's his father's company. And the manager treats him very badly and tells him, go downstairs to the basement. There's some people there doing menial work, schlepping boxes. Join them. You should also schlep the boxes. He gets a shock. This is my father. He's been so good to me. This is all he has for me. He goes downstairs. Some lower end people there, schlepping boxes, taping them up. It's not for him. And the co-workers are not being nice to him. He goes upstairs. He tries to get somebody to work for him, to work together with him. Nothing doing. Everywhere he goes, every place he turns, he's being challenged. And the weeks go by and the months go by, he feels bad to complain. But eventually he goes into his father's office and he says, Daddy, he says, you've been so good to me over all these years. Why? Why is it so difficult for me to get just a regular job where people will treat me well. Can't you say something to the workers, to the manager? And his father says to him, okay, you've had a few months of this experience. I'll explain to you my idea. He says, I've given you everything. Total present. I've given you so much clothes. You never had to worry about anything. Everything was sorted. Anything that could have gone wrong, you didn't even know about because I sorted it out before you were challenged by it. But life's not like that. And there's going to be challenges. There's going to be stumbling blocks. And you have to be prepared. So therefore, life is starting. I needed you to have, without knowing, you had to have challenges. So I set it up for you. I told them to treat you badly. I told them to send you down to the basement. I told them to make it difficult for you at every juncture they could. And so they did. But don't worry. In a few weeks, you'll have your office. You get your manager's chair. You'll be where you belong. But you had to go through this to know that life's not going to be smooth at all points. You have to be prepared. I did it for your good. He says, oh, now I have an understanding. Thank you. And he shakes his father's hand. He says, thank you for everything you've done for me. Even this was for my good. Now I understand. That's Pesach and Matan Torah. All the presents, everything was given. They were in Mem Tashari Tom, and all of a sudden they're being loaded on and showered with so much goodness. All the miracles going through the desert that we spoke about before. Comes Matan Torah, of course, Nasa and Ishmael, I'll take the job. I don't even know what it is. But it has to be everlasting, and therefore the Rebbeinu picks up the mountain, Kof Aleim Har Kegiges. You've got to be prepared for real life. It's not always going to be easy. There'll be times it won't be so easy to be Torah Yidden. Holocaust, other times, Spanish Inquisition, all through history, and in our lives itself also. Challenges. It's not always so easy. Kof Aleim Har Kegiges. Purim is totally different. Purim is like someone who has a son who's working in his pharmaceutical company. They formulate medicines, invent different medications, and they suddenly realize it's a very successful company, they do lots of export, and suddenly they notice that things are going wrong. The competition always seems to be just a few weeks behind. They come out with something, they've got their own scientists coming up with their own chemists, coming up with formulas and medicines, and within a few weeks the competition has exactly the same product. And so they get some professionals, they look into it, and unbelievably they trace it down to the child, the son of the boss. That's who's been selling secrets of the company. And without a choice, the father calls in the son, he's very angry, and he tells his son, you've lost your job, and never mind that, you've got to move out of town, move out of the country, and he sends him to some town somewhere at the end of the world, with nothing but the shirt on his back. And the child, this is the situation he's in, and the boy starts trying to make some food, some money, he needs to start life. And so the boy then borrows money, he finds some people to have a bit of compassion, borrows a few £1,000, rents a kiosk, gets a few fruit and vegetables in boxes, some drinks on the shelves, something just to try and make a parnosa, something to get by, something to make a living. And on his first few weeks, he suddenly sees, to his dismay, across the street, there's a construction site beginning. A whole team of people are beginning to build something across the street. He was on a quiet street trying to get the locals to buy some food from him. He asks them, what are you building? And they tell him, we're building a supermarket. So that Schwarzer Eugen, he gets so upset. Never mind that where's Parnassus going to be from? How is he going to make a living? But he owes thousands of pounds as well. He doesn't have a penny for himself. And here they're building this huge supermarket. And he sees it going up day by day. 16 tills, massive wide aisles, trolleys outside, shelves. It's beautiful. He's not going to be able to compete with this with his three cardboard boxes and a little fridge of drinks. And he starts falling into a depression. And then a few days after the supermarket actually opened its doors and started advertising, the manager, he's wearing a pressed shirt, nice tie, walks into his little kiosk and he says, good morning. And he says, it's okay, stay in your shop. He says, no, I need to talk to you. He says, what do you want? And he tells him, I used to work for your father's pharmaceutical company. Your father sent me here to build this shop. It's yours. The supermarket's yours. I work for you. You're my boss. Let me show you to your office. That's Purim. We're thrown away, we're so far away. We've made mistakes and we find ourselves flung somewhere in the middle of Bavel. And in the difficulty, in the pain, where everything seems to be going so wrong, Haman's causing so much trouble, suddenly we wake up one day, Haman's hanging and his 10 sons are meeting in a row up there. And Mordechai's riding the horse with his purple robes. He becomes the boss of the very supermarket which was about to destroy him and putting him into depression. That's the difference. And in that, this boy obviously takes his first flight out to his father and gives him a hug and a kiss and thanks him so much for that. Even in such a situation, he was always there for him and building and thinking of him. And it was all for his good. That's Purim and Pesach. So Purim has an extra level of Ahava. Purim has an extra dimension over Pesach. And before I give a speech, I usually like to say it to someone whose opinion I value, at least one person. So a couple of days ago, I said over this speech, and this person says to me, "You need more of a raya. Where's your raya going to be from that Purim has an extra aspect of Ahava?" So here it is. The Gemara says in Megillah Yudalad Amud Aleph, the Gemara says, "Gedoila hasoras tabas." The giving over of the ring from Achashverosh to Haman was greater, had more of an effect than the 48 Nevi'im and 7 Nevi'os that Klal Yisrael had admonishing them and putting them straight onto the path. Let's understand this for a second. Two drunks sitting at a party, Haman and Achashverosh. Haman turns to Achashverosh and says, "Sell me the Jews, 10,000. Achashverosh says, "They're yours." And Achashverosh takes off his ring, gives it to Haman. That movement, that little act of moving over the ring had more of an effect than 48 Nevi'im with their unbelievable musadrashas. Had we had one of them, our blood would boil for the rest of our lives. Yirmiyahu and all the other Nevi'im, the 7 Nevi'os and all their musadrashas and all their encouragement. That movement had more of an effect. It's the equivalent today of the President of America giving over all the nuclear power, knowledge and know-how and actual nuclear warheads to the ISIS. That's the effect that it had. The ring of the king has gone over to Haman, the arch enemy of the Jews. And so what happened, what transpired then was a national experience of tshuva never even remotely equaled in the history of humanity. Klal Yisrael suddenly realized the ring is in the hands of Haman. The Pasuk says in the Megillah Pasuk Ches, that when there's a ring, the king's ring is used to stamp a decree, there's no going back. So Klal Yisrael see the ring's in the hands of Haman. The atom bomb is with the ISIS. And suddenly there's a huge tshuva movement in Klal Yisrael, never equaled in history. And suddenly, and through that unbelievable fear, through that unbelievable depression, all of a sudden, Klal Yisrael see the supermarket's for us. You're the boss of the shop. Also, for the hapichu, Haman's the one hanging up there. There's an outpouring of love, which was never before felt. So Purim does have that extra dimension of realizing that in all situations, the Ribbono Shel Olam loves us. The Rambam was a great doctor, physician. And once one of his Rishonim friends, I think it was, I won't say the name, I don't remember. One of his Rishonim friends came to visit. You can imagine he expected to be welcomed as one of the great Rishonim of the times. And as he walks into the Rambam's house, the Rambam sends him directly down to the basement. In a dark, damp basement, the door's locked. And that's it. He can't work out what's happened to him. What have I done wrong? The Rambam treats me like this, the God Al-Hador, the great Rambam. This is how he treats me. Every half a day, a plate of food comes through the door, no one's talking to him. Nothing's improving. He can't believe his situation. After 2-3 days of sitting in this situation, he begins to cry. What could I have done to deserve this treatment? What could I have done to anger the Rambam so much? And he begins to cry tears. And after a few hours of crying, he calms himself down. He composes himself. And suddenly the door flies open. He finds himself in light. And there's a whole entourage there. There's a few people, their servants. And they take him nicely upstairs. And he goes into this huge room with laden tables spread with food. And the Rambam's waiting in his Shabbos best. And he gives him a shalom aleichem. He can't work out what's flying. For 3 days you treat me like a gangster. And then you treat me like this. And the Rambam says, I think I owe you an explanation. He says, sure, you sure do. And the Rambam tells him, when you walked into the house, I saw in your eyes an illness, tiny microscopic worms that can eat up and cause terrible damage. The only way to heal it is with crying tears. Go and force a man to cry tears. It's not going to work. So I had to put you through that, through those few days, through that terrible few days, in order for you to cry. And as soon as my people downstairs told me that you had cried for a few hours, I immediately gave you the welcome that you truly deserve. And so the treatment was all for your good. And of course he says to Ram, thank you so much. Realizing that the pain itself was out of love, and that really it was all only for the benefit of the receiver, of the recipient. But Purim, we have to know, is not a one-time achievement. It's not like Klal Yisrael once went through a Purim, recognized the glory of Hashem, and Hashem takes care of them in all situations, a one-time achievement for all generations. No. It's an achievement that Klal Yisrael reached, a level that Klal Yisrael reached once, and remains with Klal Yisrael forever. It's a darga that we reached. It's a level that Klal Yisrael has achieved, and now is true for all generations. And therefore, once we've had Purim as a nation, once the nation has experienced Purim, Purim now enhances our Pesach. So although in those times we said Pesach was, there was an element of Yira, Kof Aleim Harka Gigas, because they don't know what's coming, everything's all about love and being showered with presents at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Once Klal Yisrael in the later years in Bavel experienced a Purim, and felt the outpouring of love of Hashem to them, and automatically they reciprocate with the love to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Now our Pesach is enhanced by the Purim that precedes it. And the truth is in Tehillim, the Tehillim of Purim, Kapitel Chaf Beis, Ayelas HaShachar, Lam Natzeach Ayelas HaShachar Mizmo LeDavid. That means that Purim is compared to dawn, when the sun comes up. And says Reb Zev Lef, why is Purim compared to dawn? So he says, if somebody's walking through a dark woods and he needs to find his way, so he has a box of matches with him, it's all he has, and every so often he takes out his match, he strikes it, and he finds another few steps, making sure he doesn't bump into a tree. Then he strikes another match, he gets a little bit of light, another few steps, and that's how he makes his way, making sure he doesn't bump. And all of a sudden, dawn, sun starts coming up, puts his matches back into his pocket, and now like a free man he makes his way out of the woods and into the town. The nisim that happened through the Goluyos, the miracles that happened were sparks of light, a match being struck here, a spark of light there, a flash of lightning, gave us a little bit of perspective that Hashem's with us. Purim is much more than that. Purim was a time when the Ribbono Shel Olam actually let the sun shine. It was dawn. It became bright. Hashem was showing us a demonstration of how He's with us at all times. I love you at all times, even when you've sold the company secret, so to speak, and you're in some far-flung country. My love is the same. I'll be there for you. I'll make sure you have panos. I'll build you a supermarket. You'll be okay. That is something which lasts throughout the generations. The demonstration of Purim is for all generations. It's not a one-time experience, and therefore Purim precedes Pesach. We come from Purim into Pesach. Pesach is enhanced by Purim, which comes the 30 days before, the Shleishim Yom, Kodem LaChag. where we prepare for the Yom Tov that's coming up. The Ramban says in Parashas Bo, the end of Parashas Bo, that the Nisan, the miracles that happened at the Exodus, at Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Nisan that happened then, were l'doiris, were for all generations. Hashem doesn't have to do these huge, colossal demonstrations of His glory and supernatural things like Dam Sfardea and Kinem, frogs all over the place, for every Apokeris that asks, says the Ramban. But He does it once, and that's what lasts through generations, the Emunah lasts. And we can add that Purim is the same. Purim, the miracles of Purim, what happens over Purim is also for all generations. So that's the connection. We started with a question. Mishenichnas Adar Marbin Besimcha is a simcha, a happiness, a halacha which applies to not only to Adar but also to Nisan. Purim and also Pesach, here's the connection. Purim precedes Pesach. Pesach is enhanced by Purim, by the love that's demonstrated between Klal Yisrael and Hashem. Matzah. On Pesach we'll be eating matzah. And the Yom Tov is actually called Chag HaMatzis. There's other mitzvahs on Pesach, Chag HaMatzis. There's something very unique about the matzah. Moral is the time of affliction. Pesach, may we be zeicha, may we merit the carbon Pesach, is for the time of the geula, the redemption. Matzah has both aspects. Because matzah is lechem oini, the bread of affliction. The bread that slaves ate through the years and that Klal Yisrael ate in Mitzrayim. And the matzah is also the bread that they ate because they didn't have time for the dough to rise when they were running out of Mitzrayim. So it represents both the times of the geula and the times of Golos. The times of affliction and the times of redemption. There was a fellow in Bnei Brak who came over to his Rav. Sorry, there was a Rav in Bnei Brak. Reb Yitzchak Shlomo Unger, the Rav of Chug Chasam Sofer, and he told Reb Yanko Galinsky this maisa. He said, a man came over to him 30 years after the Second World War to tell him a little bit about what happened to him during the war and a question that he has 30 years later. And the man tells him that 30 years ago we went hungry and my entire family was wiped out, but I was sent into a labor camp. And in the labor camp, we were assigned a block, and I had a roommate there, a Gehoi Ben Yid, a very special person, a Kaddish Elyon, who was always talking about Yiras Shamayim, Emuna, we must strengthen our belief. And he was trying to do any mitzvah he could. And he always encouraged everybody with enthusiasm, with as much positivity as he could. And when it came closer to Pesach, he kept saying, you know, morrow we have plenty of over here. It's a life of morrow. But what's going to be with matzah? Where are we going to get matzah from? And he kept talking about it as the days got closer to Pesach. People say, matzah in the camps. Where are we going to get matzah from? And not so long before Pesach, the Allies, it was closer to the end of the war, the Allies shot a bomb exploded over a warehouse just outside of the camp. And there were bags of flour now, totally ripped open with flour all over the floor. So he kept encouraging his friend, this man telling the story. He said, go get some flour from those bags of flour that have opened up and spilt out. He said, you're crazy. He said, no, but your group goes past. He said, it's a matter of life and death. If I just stoop down, he begs him, please go and get some flour. We can try and do something here. And so with all the encouragement, he goes at the risk of his life and he gets a scoop of flour. And then each time they have a small break, he keeps working on this. He takes stones and he grinds the flour. Then he gets a plate of metal and he gets it white hot to work as an oven. He takes a little metal rod and makes the holes. Takes a little bit of water, mixes it with the flour, puts it onto his white hot sheets of metal. And lo and behold, a tiny little matzah. A thick little dough baked on a white hot metal in the middle of the camp. And that's the relatively easy part. Now he has to get it back into the camp. There's guards everywhere. They're there to check to see what people have in their pockets. But he gets past the first point. He gets into the camp, all excited. He's holding his matzah. There's two kizesim in his thick little matzah, one for himself and one from his holy friend. And he gets past the first checkpoint, and as he goes into the camp and he gets closer to his barrack, he gets closer to the building, there's a guard standing outside, and he says, "What do you have under your arm?" And he shoves his arm open and the matzah falls onto the ground. And being a German as he was, he crushes the matzah with his boot and slaps the man across his face, and he falls into a faint. He was weak enough as it was. And as he falls to the ground, with his hand, he grabs some of the crumbs that are left over from the matzah into his fist and falls away into a faint. And his friend comes running out. The German found someone else to check him meanwhile. And the man comes running out. He washes his face and he tries to revive him. He puts him onto the bed. He says, "But look, I still have something." He opens his hand. And there's some crumbs of the matzah in his hand. But they look at each other. There's only one kazayis. And it's Seder tonight. And they start arguing. And the man says to him, "It was my idea. I told you to." He says, "You're crazy. I risked my life for this. Very nice, your idea. I was the one who got the flour. I was the one who mixed it. I was the one who made this matzah. I brought it in. I got hit almost to death just a few hours ago. You're not taking this matzah from me." He says, "I beg of you, I've never missed matzah in my life. No Seder has ever gone by in my life without eating matzah. You can't do this to me. I'll teach you halal. I'll say halal to you. You'll say after me. I know much more than you." And they're going back and forth and back and forth, and he doesn't leave him alone. And each one wants to eat the matzah. And then the man says to him, "You know what? You eat the matzah." The man who made the matzah says, "You eat the matzah, but I'm keeping the schus." And that's the deal they do. "I'm keeping the schus. All the pain that I went through, all the effort that I went into to making this matzah, I'm keeping. You eat the matzah." And that night, he eats the matzah, his holy roommate. And the man who made the matzah keeps his chus for himself. The next day, unfortunately, he was saying halal loud, this heiliger roommate, this bunkmate, and he was shot by a Nazi bullet. And this man telling this story says, "But I survived the war. And there's a reason why I'm telling you this story," he says. "Last night he came to me in a dream. Beautiful face, white flowing robes. And he said to me, 'I'm begging you for the schus of eating that matzah. I have a great Gan Eden, but it's missing. I ate matzah, but I don't have the schus. I don't have the merit. I don't have the reward for eating that matzah. Please give it to me.' And I said to him in my dream, 'All the effort that I went into, I made the matzah.'" We had the same argument again. "I'm not giving it away. It's my schus. But it was my idea. It was my schus." He said he looked very disappointed. And that was the end of the dream. I said, I woke up the next morning, I'm thinking to myself, am I right or wrong? And I'm asking the Rav this question. So Rabbi Unger says, this is not a question for a Rav, it's a question for a Rebbe. And he sends it to the Machnofke Rebbe. And he goes into the Rebbe, he waits for Kabbalah's Kal, and comes his turn to go in, and the Rebbe tells him, "Yashrus, it's correct to be Mevata." He says, "Rebbe, Yashrus, it's correct to be Mevata, to give in? To give up on my merits, my rewards of this mitzvah which I so painstakingly performed?" He says, "Let me explain it to you. You're alive. He's not. You have children. Everything they do is yours, chusim. How many Pesachs can you still observe? Have you already observed since the war? How many mitzvahs have you done? Can you do? Could you still do?" That was it for him. That was the last mitzvah. He died the next day. He's begging you, "Please give me that one mitzvah that I could still have. He cannot do another mitzvah. Therefore, it's yashrus, it's correct. Give him the schus." He says, "Okay, Rebbe, if that's what you say, I'm a vata." He says, "No, you got to do this right. Here's the keys to the base of Medrash. Go into the shul. There's no one there now. Open up the Aron Kodesh. And in front of Sifrei Torah, I want you to relive that moment. Put yourself back into the camps and the argument you had with him and tell him that you're Mevata." As he goes into the shul, he opens up the shul. And in a dark, big shul, he goes up the Aron Kodesh. Psicha Sa'aron opens up. And in front of Sifrei Torah, it's extremely difficult. He relives the trauma of the war years. And he's imagines again taking those crumbs of matzah and giving it to his friend and keeping the schus, and he says, "I'm a vata." And he goes drained from the experience. And he goes home and he falls faint onto his couch. And his friend comes back to him in a dream. And he tells him, with a big smile on his face, thank you so much for this chus. Mats of affliction, in the deepest, darkest moments of history. Crumbs of mats in someone's hand. Lechem oini. That's real lechem oini, bread of affliction. But boy, is that a bread of triumph. A bread of freedom. The same matzah. The matzah of golos and the matzah of geula. Matzah has both aspects. Love of the Ribbono Shel Olam in golos, in the bitter moments, and the times of geula, redemption and triumph over all odds, against all odds. And finally, the idea of the Ahava that we have and experience on Pesach now with the extra dimension of Purim. Total love, not just Ha'akigigis. Understanding that everything is for the good. Who is that for? And this is actually an argument between Paroi and Moshe Rabbeinu. Paroi was known nowadays, little Rosh trying to get rid of the Jews. Paroi was the good old type of Rosh. He was a Talmud Chacham. These guys were good. You know, Haman knew his stuff. He had what to say about the Jews. Paroi too. Paroi says to Moshe Rabbeinu, when a little chip breaks into his armor, and he starts agreeing to maybe the Gidon going out into the desert to give some karbonos to Hashem. He says, "Mi va mi aholchem? Who will be going? Who's traveling into the desert?" Says the Medrash, what was his problem here? Why do you want to know who's going? Says the Medrash, "Mi va mi? Mi is keneged the posuk of mi yale b'har Hashem." And the Vomi is Omi Yokum im Koin Kotchoi. The two me's of Paroi and the two me's of those Psukim. What's the connection? Who will rise upon the mountain of Hashem and stand in the place of His glory? What's that got to do with me Vomi HaHulchem? Who's going to serve Hashem? And the idea is, Paroi was saying, who in your people can actually go up the mountain of the Ribbono Shel Olam? It can't be all of you. A couple of priests are holy. Some sheikhs, some imams, they represent the nation. So who's going? Who are the representatives? Who are the ambassadors of the Jewish people? And here's the showdown. Here's the argument of Moshe Rabbeinu and Paroi. The two ideologies coming and clashing together. Paroi says, you need representatives. Who are they? Tell me their names, or make a list, and they'll be allowed to go. Says Moshe Rabbeinu, no. Everybody goes. B'nareinu v'zkeneinu, b'vneseinu b'vaneinu. Everybody's going. Men, women, children. Everyone's going. Because in Klal Yisrael, everybody has a shaychus. Everybody's connected. At the Seder table, we have a family sitting together. The tradition in Klal Yisrael is the more the merrier at the Seder table. Different generations getting together when that's possible. And we have the representations of the four different sons. And the Torah particularly mentions in this case four different types of children. And all of them get answers. Some less connected, some more, some will be connected one day. But everybody's sitting at the table, even the Rosha. All four children are at the table. And so, at the Seder, when everybody is connected to the traditions and the Simcha of the Nisim that come from Adar, with Purim, which enhances the following Pesach, the Yom Tov of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Nisim that lighten up the Golos like the dawn, instead of just sparks that lighten up in the woods, like the dawn which brightens up and lasts throughout the generations, we are zeicha that each one who's sitting around the table will merit to have the light and experience it forevermore. Be'ezus Hashem.